Спасибо большое. Dean Pishkov, Director Romanoff, my friends, it is a great pleasure for me to be here at IMGIMO, which I was told has been referred to by Dr. Henry Kissinger as the Harvard of Russia. I am a graduate of Harvard, and it's possible that Dr. Kissinger has a more favorable view of that institution than I do. In any event, knowing a little about the relationship between that institution and this country, I would advise you, I would hope that you will not take the comparison too seriously. But I am here to speak about a Harvard professor, my father, who was, according to President Derek Bach of Harvard, the words that he spoke at the memorial service in 2006, the longest serving professor in the history of that institution, if you count the full span from his first arrival there in 1934 until his passing in 2006. I want to speak to you today about the central period in my father's life, about the moment roughly from 1952 into the late 1960s, when he emerged as one of the dominant, perhaps the dominant, certainly American economist, and one of the most dominant economic voices in the world at that time. This is part of a sequence of lectures that I will be giving in Moscow over the course of the next few days. The one I'm giving you, although I'm giving it first, is actually the second lecture. And I'll give one more in a few days on the aftermath of the my father's vision over the last 50 years, and one on the formation of his ideas, and I'll give on, I guess, Thursday. Today I want to focus on the heart of the matter. I will say a few words about his background, about where, about the environment from which he emerged. As I think it's essential to understand that he, along with many others of his time, was not primarily framed by intellectual forces. He was born on a farm, raised in a climate of progressive North American agriculture in southern Canada, in Ontario, in the 1920s into the 1930s. He pursued agricultural economics initially at Berkeley, joined the early New Deal, where the crisis of the agricultural economy was perhaps the central initial issue, went on and absorbed the thinking of John Maynard Keynes at Cambridge in 1937-1938, although Keynes was not there at the time, came back and was caught up in the practical questions of industrial mobilization and especially price control in the second, in the early phases, I should say, of the Second World War. He was a practical man. by comparison with that, his formation in academic economics was eclectic, incidental, and one might argue, insubstantial. This was a great advantage. It kept his head clear and open, unfuddled by nonsense, to take a phrase from Keynes in 1929. By the late 1940s and 1950s, his reading interests were largely in areas of organization and management. Figures like James Burnham, Herbert Simon, Adolf Burl, Gardner Means. His closest friends amongst economists were people like the British economists of Hungarian origin, Nicholas Kaldor and Thomas Balog, Gunnar Myrdal in Sweden, perhaps a little more distantly, people like Shigeto Tsuru in Japan, Stanislav Menshikov in the USSR. His closest friend at Harvard was an eminently practical Russian by the name of Vasily Leontief, the father of input-output analysis, a graduate of the University of Petrograd, and a very delightful and amusing man who was my first economics instructor. He became, my father did, a rising celebrity in the 1950s, cultivating a sparring relationship with Milton Friedman, and later on with William F. Buckley Jr. In politics, he maintained very close links, beginning in the 1930s with his undergraduate pupil at Winthrop House in Harvard, a congressman and later senator by the name of John F. Kennedy, and with a neighbor from Alexandria, Virginia in 1940, just outside Washington, who became by that time Senate Majority Leader by the name of Lyndon Johnson. In the 1960 campaign, after a small debacle, Senator Kennedy at one point said to him, "Ken, I don't want to hear about farm policy, agricultural policy, from anyone but you, and I don't want to hear it from you either." So he had, unlike Keynes, no struggle to escape. His independence from the textbooks and the dogma was complete from the beginning. And literary success, American Capitalism, The Great Crash, The Affluent Society, brought him an audience that was unrivaled by any peer. Not merely in the industrial and democratic West, but in rising Japan, in Fabian India, in the Khrushchev reform period of the USSR, and even though we did not know it at the time, in Maoist China. In the United States, he was so widely read that Milton Friedman felt obliged to write books against him and eventually a television series, Free to Choose. The economics profession took steps to make sure that the experience of John Kenneth Galbraith could not be repeated by anyone else, and it succeeded in this. The practical person posed a lethal threat to impractical thought. My father's rise to global fame came through five books that were published between 1952 and 1967. American Capitalism, The Great Crash of 1929, The Affluent Society, and after an interval of nearly a decade, The New Industrial State. The other books appeared during those years, including a technical essay on price control, a theory of price control, a collection of essays called The Liberal Hour, a diary, Ambassador's Journal, a memoir, The Scotch, two works of satirical fiction, mainly at the State Department, at the profession of foreign policymakers. They were called The McLandris Dimension and The Triumph. They were also years of my father's main political engagement, that included 2 years of diplomatic service in India. Let's see if I can make this thing now work. Oops. And the Democratic Policy Council of the 1950s, to the New Frontier and the Design of the War on Poverty and the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson. This is a photograph of the Democratic Policy Council meeting in the late 1950s, and then my father's in the front talking to President Harry Truman, who was presiding over that particular meeting. In India, from 1961 to 1963, he served President Kennedy, and there's a photograph of us at the Delhi Zoo. I'm right in the center holding the leopard cub, whose name was Jumna. You can see my father on one side of the photograph, my mother on the other. The leopard cub survived with us for about 6 weeks and then had to be given back to the zoo because leopards really don't make good pets. But those of you who are going into the diplomatic service, this is a sign of the kind of thing that you might have to deal with at one point or another. Ultimately, he became a dissident, a leader of a group called Americans for Democratic Action at the moment of breach between American liberals and the Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson, over the Vietnam War. The head of a movement called Negotiations Now over Vietnam, and ultimately the campaign of Eugene McCarthy for the presidency in 1968. And a bitter ending, I think it's fair to say, came in that year, 1968, marked by assassinations, the police riot at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. I was there in August. The election of Richard Nixon to the presidency in November. And in this way began the strange death of American liberalism and the deepening reaction of the remaining 38 years of his life. There was a concern that he evoked at practically every opportunity. And I'll read you a short passage from this, from the 1956 edition of American Capitalism. That his work, quote, would not seem very relevant when viewed from the radioactive debris that would remain after a war, even a victorious one. He was not in favor of, quote, sudden, massive, and very high temperature extinction, unquote. And the thought of this possibility was never very far from his mind. It would be restated in the final word of his final book, The Economics of Innocent Fraud, published in 2004 when he was 94. That said, American Capitalism, copy of the cover, a nice sort of socialist realist design on that one, is about economic success, about the great success of the American industrial system in the years following the Second World War, which were years of expansive prosperity and the sustained fruits of the New Deal social and political innovations, including Social Security, labor rights, the minimum wage, a strong public presence at the forefront of industrial research and public investment, especially in higher education, transportation system. The irony and the pleasure of the book lay in the discomfort this success caused for business leaders and conservative economists, to the former because of their ingrained adverse view of socialism and Keynesianism, or of any social order that they themselves did not command, and to the latter, the economists, because the American system could never be confused or reconciled with their ideal of competitive equilibrium or the self-sufficient free market. So my father wrote in the opening passage of that book, such as the aerodynamics and wing loading of the bumblebee, that in theory it cannot fly, says, but it does, and the fact that it defies the august wisdom of Isaac Newton and Orville Wright must cause the bumblebee a fair amount of psychological trauma. The antitrust movement, too, was nonplussed by events and circumstances, their approach plainly absurd in an economy driven by rapid development of new techniques, products, technologies, and energy sources. The phrase countervailing power, checks and balances in the economic sphere, was the practical answer, and the path between free market utopians on one side and the problematic monomania of state socialism on the other. The book captured the spirit of the moment and sold, if my memory is correct, about 250,000 copies. The Great Crash, 1929, was a summer's writing project in the Dartmouth Library in 1955. And it worked new threads into my father's intellectual tapestry. These threads would reappear periodically in later work, in Money, Whence It Came, Where It Went, in The Age of Uncertainty, and in A Short History of Financial Euphoria. They dealt with the highly unstable institutions and comic follies of money and credit, with the susceptibility to ingenious fraud of capital markets, and with the pompous self-regard of the powerfully self-inflated gentleman who liked to rule over all creation from Park Avenue and Wall Street. The Great Crash told an internal story, financial folly, through the vignette of a single episode, the crash of 1929, which was in 1955 living memory. Largely, the story is largely taken from the newspapers of the hour. And it again teased the economists, for whom financial events could never be properly causal, only they reflected deeper phenomena. The public thought otherwise. This was by far the largest seller of my father's books, and it has never been out of print, except for a few months in early 1987. And it came back into print very rapidly right after the stock market fell by a third on October 19th of that year. I called my father that evening. It was hard to get through. Those were the days when people had phone lines in their houses, you know. And eventually, I picked up the phone. And I greeted him. He said, "James, is that you?" I said, "Yes, Dad." He said, "Not to worry, I've been in cash for 3 weeks." And there was a pause, and he said, "But I'm sorry to say that the same cannot be said of your mother." But she found it difficult to sell the General Electric that her family had bought from Edison for a dollar. In 2003, I met Fidel Castro in Havana. And once he established who I was, his very first words were to me, "The Great Crash, my favorite book. I have a copy on my night table." In 2009, after the debacle, it came right back and sold about 50,000 copies. We come now to The Affluent Society, a book of, let's see, there we are, considerable interest, in part because it's been published this year in Russia for the very first time. Very interesting phenomenon, considering that my father's work was well known in Russia and the Soviet Union the time that it was appearing for the first time. It's a book which has a special interest from my point of view, because as you can see, it's dedicated in part to me. And it was the book that will most decisively mark his place in the history of economic thought and in the literature of the mid-20th century. It is here that the phrase conventional wisdom appears. Oh, there's how Dad inscribed that particular copy to me. You can't read it, of course. It was his handwriting. It's totally illegible. But aside from "love, Dad," it says, "Sorry about the edition, but it's more valuable," meaning he'd given me a first edition. So this was the practical man always thinking about the value of his presence to his children. But it is here, and I should say, a book which had resonance around the world. And in this particular instance, here's a cover, which is made of used matchsticks and shellac by three professors of economics who were imprisoned by the fascist junta in Greece in the late 1960s, after 67. And they sat in prison and they made covers for books from the prison library. And that's the one that they gave to my father afterwards. It's one of my most, in some ways, my most precious possession. A It is here that the phrase conventional wisdom, you see this chapter 2, the concept of the conventional wisdom, first appears. Here that such phrases as the revised sequence, the problem of social balance, are defined. Here that we read of private opulence and public squalor. Amartya Sen, at my father's memorial service a half century later, remarked, it was like reading Shakespeare. It's full of quotations. But the book's strength and importance lay in its frontal assault on the core of neoclassical economics and in setting a vast progressive agenda for decades to come, for an agenda that covered everything from human rights to women's rights to environmental policy, to the whole range of public and social questions that had lain aside in the economics of scarcity, but that my father argued would be central to an economics of abundance. Its strength and importance lay in its frontal assault on the core of neoclassical economics. As I just said, it was not accidental. As I learned years later while giving a memorial lecture honoring the civil rights lawyers Clifford and Virginia Durr in Montgomery, Alabama, that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had two books with him when he composed the letter from the Birmingham jail. One was the Bible, and the other was the Affluent Society. The Affluent Society is incontestably the most accessible and most widely read general critique of neoclassical economics ever written. More arguably, it's also one of the most profound. For the Affluent Society cuts to the core proposition that economics is about scarcity, and therefore to the bedrock assumptions of utility maximization in consumption and profit maximization in the conduct of the business firm. If you've taken an economics class on the Western model, as I suppose many of you have, those propositions are probably still very much the core of the textbook theory. But unlike the theories of imperfect competition, Joan Robinson, Edward Chamberlain, which had been introduced in the 1930s, the Affluent Society was not merely a departure from the ancient dichotomy between pure competition and monopoly. It does not hold perfect competition as the ideal case. The task of policy is not to try to approximate that supposed ideal. Antitrust, the favored tool of those holding such a view, is therefore mostly irrelevant. And unlike in Keynes's general theory, a book for economists and largely misread by them, there is no full employment world in which the competitive market comes into its own, even as a special case. There is thus in the Affluent Society no scope for the neoclassical synthesis whose practical consequence was for decades the division of instruction into macro and micro. Again, if you've taken economics, I suppose that's something that you had to suffer through. I've often argued that Christmas exists because it enables students to forget micro before they take macro, or the other way around. Nor, in contrast to Schumpeter, did Galbraith describe the world as it is, a task from which Schumpeter did not shrink, only to accept it as the best one can do. In this book, The Affluent Society, the task of defining and facing problems cannot be escaped or evaded. The point of departure, I would argue, was Thorstein Veblen, who in 1898 characterized economic man in a phrase that I can't resist quoting: the hedonistic conception of man is that of a lightning calculator of pleasures and pains who oscillates like a homogeneous globule of desire of happiness under the impulse of stimuli that shift him about the area but leave him intact. He has neither antecedent nor consequent. He is an isolated, definitive human datum in stable equilibrium except for the buffets of the impinging forces that displace him in one direction or another. Self-poised in elemental space, he spins symmetrically about his own spiritual axis until the parallelogram of forces bears down upon him whereupon he follows the line of the resultant. When the force of the impact is spent, he comes to rest, a self-contained globule of desire as before. This hypothetical person, commodity-obsessed, asocial, one-dimension, insatiable, rational, but in a way that any competent psychologist would qualify as insane, forms the bedrock of the neoclassical vision, the basis of its theory of value and hence its theory of markets and prices. It is the pure expression of a religious creed without parallel in any life science, a pseudophysics of particles imbued with will, redolent, as Veblen says in the same essay, of when nature abhorred a vacuum. To borrow a phrase from Keynes, it not only is nonsense, but it sounds like nonsense to any ordinary, uninstructed person who bothers to examine the matter with a fresh and open mind. To the economist, as my father put it, wants originate in the personality of the consumer. All economic policy, in turn, is geared toward maximum production. And this is justified by the urgency of those original insatiable wants. He wrote, "Were it so that a man on arising each morning was assailed by demons, which instilled in him a passion, sometimes for silk shirts, sometimes for kitchenware, sometimes for chamber pots, sometimes for orange squash, there would be every reason to applaud the effort to find the goods, however odd, that quench the flame. But not so if production only fills a void that it has itself created. In that case, one might wonder if the solution lay with more goods or fewer demons." With a vested interest in output, corporate capitalism resembles state socialism, but now the critical difference comes into focus. State socialism defined and generally met basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, according to patterns set by planners concerned in principle with input-output efficiency. They were not particularly adept, for the most part, at managing a labor force, at distribution networks. They were not interested in the novelty of product design. Art, architecture, music, and film were not subordinated to the commercial world. Corporate capitalism recognized the prior necessity of framing wants, of designing products around which wants could be framed, of triggering the impulse of emulation, and of constructing a relatively narrow, focused, and effective production system, the corporation itself, which, though necessarily large and integrated, did not face the cyclopean task of organizing production on the national scale, nor of balancing every need against every other. Corporations coordinate in a simple way. They need only to grow at the same rate as all the others. A hyper-successful corporation may grow faster, but only for a time. With somewhat decentralized units concentrating on specific industrial segments and coordinating on the growth of total effective demand, the problems of creating and meeting induced wants is solved in a robust way. But it is a way that exposes the hollowness of the entire social system, that aggravates rather than resolves inequalities and hierarchies, that is profoundly anti-democratic, predatory, and even totalitarian in its repression of those who advocate some other system. Henry Ford said the Model T could have any color so long as it was black. American democracy tolerates any social system so long as it is capitalism. But as a system that prospers only when resources are cheap, inequalities tolerable, and when the environmental costs may be safely neglected. The appeal of the affluent society to the critical spirit of the 1960s lay in providing a definitive demolition of the 20th century's leading efforts to disguise corporate capitalism as a system of free markets with sovereign consumers. It exposed the universal microeconomics as ridiculous and did so without recourse to Marxist polemic, to class analysis, or dialectical materialism. While my father's approach to Marx was always respectful, it was never deferential. He writes, for instance, that if, quote, Marx had been entirely wrong, he would not have been influential. I suppose this attitude may have played a role in the non-publication of the Affluent Society in Russia, in Russian language, until this year. Otherwise, my father's works were published in the USSR and fairly widely read. In the United States, the leading current of radical economics consisted largely of Marxians, who maintained methodological dialogue with neoclassicals and owed their academic survival to the latter's need to have a foil. Those radicals tended to maintain a wary, though respectful, distance from my father. He was, after all, a New Dealer and a Keynesian, an advisor and friend to Kennedy and to Johnson, and an intellectual threat no less to them than to the neoclassicals. Even though in academic disputes over hiring decisions in economics, he would always side with the radicals and sometimes paid a pretty stiff cost for it, there was never a radical push to create a permanent niche for Galbraith's disciples in academic economics, and no such niche exists or has ever existed. My father wrote that the Affluent Society was a window, and that this book, The New Industrial State, was the house. This book was drafted in the late 1950s, initially. The manuscript was stored in a bank vault during the Kennedy years, which we spent in India. And then he got it out when he returned in 1963, finished it up for publication in 1967. In the midst of the Great Society, the War on Poverty, and the War in Vietnam. Perhaps the peak year of American corporate power, of military hubris, of post-war prosperity, and social progress. It was also a moment when the American way had its peak reputation of the world, both as a model and a threat. Jean-Jacques Servan-Schreiber wrote and published Le Défi Américain, The American Challenge, that year, expressing the ambivalent mood. The Yankees had a superior corporate form, and it was going to take over in Europe. For economics, the new industrial state was a defining moment. It was the peak Galbraithian challenge. It expressed the imperative of placing organization on a plane above markets, for it was organization. Ruthless, efficient, large scale, and only organization that permits the division of tasks required for the deep application of technology, the long lead times required for product design, the management of specific demand, so that sales can be assured and renewed, and the management of aggregate demand so that investment and scrapping plans can be coordinated. In general, organization permits comprehensive control of a planning system of corporate planets around which the rings of small and medium businesses revolve. For those who continued to insist on the small and medium business as the ideal type, my father expressed a kind of amused contempt. Quote, the person who sets out to study buildings in Manhattan on the assumption that all are alike will have difficulty passing from the surviving brownstones to the skyscrapers. And he will handicap himself even more if he imagines that all buildings should be like brownstones and have load-bearing walls while the others are abnormal. You have a similar phenomenon here in Moscow, I see, with these lovely New York-style skyscrapers of a 21st century type, if you treat them as being the same as the standard Moscow building, you're going to have a problem understanding architecture, it seems to me. The new industrial state described the American economy, along with its power structures, mitigating and countervailing forces, and also its government and the military-industrial complex, as it was. The portrait is not on balance hostile. This is not Baran and Sweezy. It's not Bowles and Gentis. To Galbraith, to my father, the system had advantages and disadvantages. flaws and challenges. But the available alternatives did not include utopia achieved at low social cost. He was always the practical man. To him, realism and analysis presaged realistic solving of problems. He never believed in the day when all problems would be solved, when, as Irving Fisher had written in 1929, stocks would reach a permanently high plateau, or when, as Robert Lucas wrote in 2000, early 2000s, the economic problem of recession and the risk of depression would go away. It was sufficient to work toward the good, not even necessarily the great society. The good society would serve as a title for a later book. Toward that end, all practical measures should be deployed, including those with which the practical man had practical experience, which was the stabilizing regulation of prices and wages. So he did not believe that the price mechanism was the free instrument of the market economy. He believed that it, along with practically everything else, was part in the essential main structure of the economy of the planning system. And there's an interesting echo of this, interestingly enough, which has only just surfaced in studies that I'm familiar with, that reflects this view in the transition of China. Specifically, an understanding by the Chinese government that that specific prices had an extraordinarily important stabilizing role, both for inflation generally, but also for the confidence building or confidence destroying character of the economic dynamic. In the United States, the price of gas and the rate of interest play this role. In China, it's the price of rice and bread and cooking oil among the key prices. Rising prices, when sufficiently rapid to be perceptible, provoke runs, speculation, hoarding, and other disruptive and antisocial behavior. They also make it hard for government to sell debt, especially over the long term. They undermine confidence in the stability of the political system and of the economic system. This was fairly obvious through the Maoist period and afterwards. To the Chinese. In American economics, where the price mechanism is left to the free market and the rate of inflation, to the tender mercies of the central bank, the monetarist dogma, this reality was not obvious at all. Or one should say that the point was willfully obscured, as it would be again in Russia in 1992, as American economists and economics were being imported wholesale. For my father, the need for stabilization of key prices was something that he had experienced personally in his role as director for prices in the Office of Price Administration in 1941-1942, and that never entirely left him in later years. And there was a day on August 15th, 1971, when President Richard Nixon, a Republican and no fan of my father's, imposed price controls on the United States economy. The Washington Post called my father for his comment, and he said, "I feel like the streetwalker who has just been told, not only is her profession legal, but the highest form of municipal service." At a remove of 50 years, this is, I should say, the back cover of the original edition of the New Industrial State. The household ascribed a caption to that photograph, which was, as soon as it appeared, I heard someone in our household say that he was saying, "Get up off the floor, both of you, and put on your clothes." It is not easy after 50 years to reconstruct or overstate the effect of the New Industrial State Nueva Industrial Neochiesfo, am I right? On American political culture and its threat to the established economics. It was, at the time, the big book by the most widely read economist since the death of Marx. Speaking from a perch at the peak of academic prestige in the most powerful country of the moment. In an alternative universe, the economics profession might have simply folded up and followed John Kenneth Galbraith to the development of a new economics suited to the world of large organizations. It could perhaps have met his challenge with innovation along Schumpeterian lines, accepting the reality of large institutions and acknowledging their problems, but refusing the tools to address them. This would have been the fascist riposte. Or it could have doubled down on its fixed beliefs and simply deny that a material difference exists between the skyscrapers and the brownstones. What it actually did was that second course. The reaction of the economics profession and its leading figures to the publication of the New Industrial State was ferocious. It was heavily attacked and dismissed, and no effort was made to come to grips with the self-evident realities that the book outlined and presented to a vast audience around the world. The economics profession instead went in the direction in which it has entombed itself over the past 50 years. This reaction was accompanied by a prodigious pretense to the status of science, a deepened commitment to impenetrable algebra, and a consequent attempt to read John Kenneth Galbraith out of the economics profession. Not really an economist. I have just added here, I'm sorry that you can't see this. This is an original cartoon by William Hamilton of the New Yorker magazine from this period. And the caption says, "Well, sir, the boy is over John Kenneth Galbraith and ready to get to work." Gives you an idea of the view that was taken at the time. In doing what it did, academic economics retreated to a neverland of obscure formal models, dogmatic policy rules, and intellectual incoherence behind which lurked lobbyists and paymasters. Monetarism, supply-side economics, rational expectations came and went. And eventually the discipline closed in upon itself and ceased largely to interact with the outside world, leaving only its second-tier representatives in public life to implement dogmatic policy rules that are locked into place. That is the story of a successful reaction to an intellectual force that was just too close to the reality of the world to be accepted by those whose responsibility it was to interpret it. And there we are. I think a great deal of the difficulties that we've experienced in my professional lifetime over the last 50 years can be traced to the successful reaction against the ideas of my father, John Kenneth Galbraith. He, of course, went on. There he is late in life. And here is a little clay model of my father and my mother in a posture, I have to say, that I never saw them reading quietly in the living room together. Thank you very much indeed.